The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good morning, everyone. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. My watch says 9:55. So I'm going to make sure my cell phone is, silenced so I don't interrupt myself. Well, if you'll join me in a brief word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Lord, I thank you so much for each person here and for the time they've taken away from their personal lives, their families, to come invest not only in themselves, but in their students, in their schools, in their families, and in the education of this next generation. I pray that this talk specifically, that your Holy Spirit would guide me in the words coming out of my mouth, that they would be a blessing to those here, that they would give them some tools, some thoughts, some inspiration to take back with them to find ways to encourage themselves and to encourage their students, not only in their study of Latin and language, but in their study of classical history and literature and poetry and art and sciences and all these wonderful studies that we have before us. I pray that you bless them this weekend and that you give them just wonderful moments of encouragement, moments of laughter and joy, and moments of great inspiration to breathe renewed life into their school come fall. In the name of Jesus Christ we pray, amen. Well, my name is Karen Moore, and this talk is Latin as the True Liberal Art. I teach Latin, Greek, Ancient Humanities at Grace Academy of Georgetown, a classical school deep in the heart of Texas and about 3.5 hours directly south on I-35. I've served there for many years as teacher, as an administrator at times, but always as a mother to my three children, two of whom are now graduates of Grace Academy, and the youngest of whom is now preparing to begin her junior year, and I'm still wrestling to come to terms with all of that. So the proposal I put forth in the synopsis harkens back to Cassiodorus, and he's the gentleman in the middle slide. This first slide really is kind of pointing to everything I'm going to talk to today. We have Cicero on your left representing the ancients. We have Isaac Newton representing the scientific age on the right, and Cassiodorus representing our classical education that binds them together right there in the middle. So in the 6th century AD, Cassiodorus ambitiously outlined a program that would integrate the proven academic studies of Greece and Rome with the study of sacred writings deemed necessary to fully equip the mind and the souls of our youth for a life lived with glory to God alone. In this text, it was Cassiodorus who laid out and defined the 7 liberal arts as the pillars of such education. Today, the term liberal arts is not so clear as it once used to be. Modern-day students and even educators might struggle to give a clear and concise definition. We in classical Christian education still look to his framework to define the magnificent 7 as grammar, logic, rhetoric, being the trivium, along with arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy being the quadrivium. The challenge we face in modern times is to redeem an approach to teaching those 7 liberal arts as part of an integrated whole. I'm going to pause there. I think we still very much seek to teach those 7 liberal arts in our classical school. Today, I really want to emphasize teaching them as an integrated whole. And I would argue that the Latin classroom is one of the last bastions where that can easily be done. This workshop intends to demonstrate how such readings of Latin literature from the time of Cicero down through the time of Newton may be woven together to showcase the 7 liberal arts as students grow in their reading proficiency. So you can turn your Latin classroom and also into a classroom of art, of physics, of rhetoric, of poetry, along with studying this wonderful language that we've all come together to love. Now, before I go into those actual exercises, I want to just do a brief recap on the progression of this liberal arts definition. It started back in the age of Greeks, building the wheel, we might say, of our educational process, and most notably with Aristotle. In that time period, we don't really have something specifically outlined, but we do see them putting together a tradition, Aristotle putting together a tradition that seems to include grammar, dialectic, Also the music, arithmetic, geonomy, and astronomy, which is not quite seven, unless, of course, you decide to include rhetoric along with dialectic, perhaps who is combining the two. The Romans are notorious for not creating a new wheel, but just engineering the old one to make it even better. And so we see in the writings of men like Cicero, Varro, Seneca, and Quintilian, them building on this idea of a liberal arts education. Varro, who's a contemporary of Cicero, in his Libri Novum Disciplinorum, he lists as the liberal arts, grammar, music, geometry, astrology, and arithmetic. So we kind of substitute in the astrology for astronomy, but we still see that same type of group. Didn't mean to reference Guardians of the Galaxy there. We go on down to Seneca and Quintilian, who were clearly inspired by Varro and by Cicero, and they mention the same types, but they expand the list a little bit, and they include medicine and architecture. I need another cup of coffee. They include medicine and architecture in that as well. And it's Quintilian who we see really kind of codifies in his Institutes of Oratory a complete course of school institution. But he defines liberal arts, he mentions them all, but he doesn't put a set number. He's talking more in terms of categories and ideas. Now we come down to the Middle Ages, where we have to bring Jesus into the wheel. So instead of reinventing it, it's Jesus, take that wheel. And we have men like Augustine beginning to have the conversation about what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem. And Augustine encourages us to certainly rob the Egyptians of their plunder, take what is good and wonderful from these ancient pagans, but let's use it to the glory of God alone. Let's study it also alongside Scripture and see how we might use it for the glory of God. They tend to pull texts from Boethius a lot. And then Cassiodorus, in his Institutes of Divine and Secular Learning, he's the one that actually sets forth then these seven liberal arts. And he equates them with the pillars of wisdom in the temple and the numerology of seven as being the number of perfection. And he is the one who sets it forth in the trivium, the quadrivium that we have today. So that's the framework, but I go through this history because I want to show you that we don't have to think of it as seven distinct pillars, but as groups and ideas of things. We're going to talk through some of what that means as we go through these today. So applying that to Latin, my argument is that Latin brings all of these things together. Because Latin was the lingua franca for so many years, really from the time of the Romans, but down into the 17th century, and even into the 1700s themselves a little bit, we see a lot of these things encapsulated in the study of Latin. We certainly have literature, history. We're going to talk today about the arts, graphic arts, as well as poetry, music, drama, those type of things. The math and the sciences. You know, most of the scientists that we know, Galileo, Newton, they had to publish their scholarly treatises in Latin. That's when they were considered scholarly material. So we still have that happening. And then, of course, the philosophy, not only of the ancients, but as we move into the medieval ages and the rise of Christendom, we also have wonderful works of theology preserved in Latin. And these are all things that you can bring into your classroom. Unless you be thinking, oh, I'm not there yet, that's for advanced. One of the things I hope to demonstrate to you today clearly is how you can bring this down even into the grammar and the logic levels. It doesn't have to be all at once. You can bring in snippets and begin planting seeds to continue to prepare them for that and help them in their minds to break down these barriers of where Latin begins and ends and see it as more of this delightful river that runs through everything. Okay, so let's first go to whatever my next slide says. Oh, yes, rhetorical devices. Now, right here, I'm showing you an image of a wonderful resource. This is the University of Kentucky, and its page is on a glossary of rhetorical terms. I absolutely love this page, and it's become a nice standby for me in my classes. Down here, and this is not an active site, so I'm not going to click on anything for you. I just wanted to show you what it looked like. So when you pull it up on your website, you go, yes, there it is. Up here across the top, you see I've written out the web link for you. However, if you were to Google University of Kentucky rhetorical devices, you will find it. It'll probably be the first thing to come up. Right here, they have a nice menu you'll see of the list of rhetorical devices, which I'm sure you can't read from where you're sitting, but trust me, it's there. It's in alphabetical order. If I was to click on one of these, it would automatically take me down to a description of that rhetorical device, a definition, and I love this, an example of that rhetorical device in Latin and an example in English. So I'm going to pull out a few of these for you, and this is something you can do even in third and fourth and fifth grade, is start to talk about the beauty of language as authors begin to take specific words and arrange them in specific ways on a page to create a specific effect. So here are a few rhetorical devices. These are my baby steps to rhetorical devices. A lot of these are in some textbooks. For example, if you use the Latin for Children series, each chapter begins with some sort of a maxim. And of course, Wainy Weedy Weeky, right there is the top, right? When we did our survey for our practicum, a number of teachers said this was one of their favorite quotes because their students loved it, because it was it had some sort of special memory for them. But that was really fun to listen to. So if I was to ask you, and this is where it becomes audience participation time, what rhetorical device might you most readily see in this one? It's one of the easiest ones for students to identify. Yes, good, with that repeated V, right? Vaini Vidi Viki or Wainy Weedy Weeky, whichever way you choose to pronounce it. I personally don't care. I just tell my students, be consistent. Don't go back and forth. Good. Anybody know one other one that's included in this one? Yes, a syndeton, very good. So no conjunctions, no connecting devices, just a brief series. But then I also like to show them, you know, authors still today use this one. The example that the University of Kentucky website gives is John F. Kennedy. Let us go forth to lead the land we love. So a nice use of alliteration. So this is a rhetorical device used by ancient orators and by modern orators. So I go down to the next one, cum tacent clamant. This is another one from the LFC reader. What rhetorical device might you say that is? It could be. They actually defined it on the UK website as an oxymoron, too, which I thought was very interesting. It's not what I first come to think of as an oxymoron, but I thought, well, actually, that could very well fit. Okay, next one. Oh, by the way, the Kentucky's example in English is Shakespeare's Hamlet, I must be cruel only to be kind. Included that one as an oxymoron, too. Festina lente, same type of thing, hurry slowly. D, now this one is a little bit larger. This one you might not want to tackle in third grade, but probably by fourth or fifth grade you could put this one up there and ask them to translate it. What rhetorical devices might you see here? Possibly anaphora. Yes, that's what I was thinking. Now technically, heek and heek are here. And hawk is this. It was technically a different word, but consider how closely they sound. I think Virgil was intentionally kind of riffing off of that. He wanted to keep that same sound and that same theme going. So hic ilius arma, here the arms of that one, meaning Juno. Hic curus fuit, here was her chariot. And then it continues on from there. I'm having trouble seeing it from here. So yes, that one. The one that the website University of Kentucky gives is from Churchill. We shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. And he keeps going on from there. We shall fight. 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 So again, showing them that rhetorical device. And it's fun to watch them begin to spot these things in the literature books that we read. Next one is one that, again, a little bit older students. This is not one that's as easy for students to recognize because they're not as used to seeing it in English. Yes, good job. Chiastic structure. So chiastic is an ABBA. Wait, did I just do three Bs? ABBA word pattern. So you see that pacis and belly are the A's, and they're both a genitive singular. In the middle are ornamenta et subsidia, which are both neuter plural, right? And so we have the ornaments of peace, right? And the supplies, the helps of war. And so he arranges it that way. Chiastic word order is something that I think is easier to do in Latin because of the loose structure than in English. But here's one from MacArthur. Those gallant men will remain often in my thoughts, and in my prayers always. So not quite as succinct, but he has the in my thoughts and in my prayers as one, as his chiastic center, right? Those gallant men will remain often in my thoughts and in my prayers always. So often and always your time words are your A's, and the place where they are in my thoughts and my prayers are your B's. Make sense? Okay. And then those are fun things you can start to look for. Last one, this is also from the Aeneid. Any guesses? This one would be metonymy. So they're using the goddess Ceres for grain. So then the corrupted cereal, this is after the storm scene and they're washed up and they're pulling all their grain off the ship. So then the corrupted grain, right, and the arms of Ceres, or the Syrian arms, and they're corrupted, excuse me, by the waves. So we're using the goddess instead place of the word for bread or cereal. And interestingly enough, they chose from Matthew 6, give us our daily bread, as a metonymy for meal, food, provisions. So I like doing that because it's a nice, succinct, short way of starting to introduce rhetorical devices. I would talk to my literature teachers and say, hey, I'm playing with these kind of rhetorical devices. If you see them in your English class, would you maybe perhaps be aware of that? Point that out to them, or if they ask you a question, be aware of that. And actually, our ninth grade teacher does a lot with rhetorical literary devices in her class, so she and I riff off of each other quite a bit. Okay, moving along. As they grow older, we can start to look at this in larger passages. There are some passages that we certainly don't want to tackle until School of Rhetoric. There are some easier passages of Latin literature, however, that you could tackle in logic. This is one that I would probably say for not middle schoolers, for older ones, because we're getting into love and wooing, and that can be problematic with middle schoolers. But within this one, we see Catullus 5 in just one phrase from him on his wooing of his girlfriend, Lesbia, who happens to be married. So we have to point that to the students. This is not a role model to follow. And then we have down here Andrew Marvel to his coy mistress, a phrase, where he is imitating Catullus's style and Catullus's message. Just goes to show you that some strategic tactics for wooing never go out of date. I think Billy Joel has a song about it too, right? Only the good die young. So let's get on with it. Anyway, so up here, what would you say are some of the rhetorical devices that you're seeing that we've already talked about? Well, with the repetition of day in, day, day in, day in, day in, day, day in, day, you still have the anaphora again, right? And it has a little bit of a feeling of an asyndeton too with it, without the conjunctions and just the quick succession. And we have that here, too, with his repetition of time words in the last half. Skipping down here, 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and in thy forehead gaze, 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. So he's got this repetition of words. And it's very interesting, I think, to show the students how we have an ancient poet and a modern poet and how one seeks to imitate the other, right? It's not as though our more modern poets like Robert Frost or Alfred Lord Tennyson or Shakespeare didn't know about the ancients. Many of them studied them and sought to emulate them and their rhetorical devices and their style. So this takes us from rhetoric into the study of music. Now, when we think of music today, we typically think of something like the honors choir that we're hearing here at ACCS this weekend, or instrumentals, right? But music to the ancients meant anything that was pertaining to the nine muses. So I have them listed down here, and I have my cheat sheet since it's hard for me to see the screen. Calliope was epic poetry, Clio, history, Euterpe, lyric poetry, Erato, love poetry, Melpomene, tragedy, Polyhymnia, hymns, Terpsichore, lyric music, dance, Thalia, comedy, and Urania, astronomy. Now, I like to point out this history being in here, because the rest of these we kind of see, a bit of theater, poetry, dance, we get the music. But Clio, history, what does history have to do with the muses? Well, this is fascinating to me. I came upon an article this year that as I was reading and exploring, and I believe it was connected to Aristotle and his discussion on tragedy and the muses, And that is that the Greeks considered history, well, actually poetry, to be a form of history. I thought, wow, I have to stop and think about that for a minute. But think about going back to Homer. We tend to classify Odyssey and Iliad as these fictional stories and poems. We don't typically think about them as history. But for the Greeks, they were an oral history. Now, like Grandpa's fish tank fishing tales and hunting tales, probably greatly distorted and greatly exaggerated, but it was their way of remembering certain places and people and heroes and events, conflated, but nonetheless, it was a history. So then jump down to the first century BC and Augustus tasking Virgil indirectly with the labor of writing the Aeneid. And what was his purpose? I want you to put together an epic poem that recalls the great history of our people, of the founding of Rome and of our lineage, that will bind our people together and bring them back together after years of civil war. And that's clearly what Virgil is doing in this epic poem. So poetry for them was a form of history. And for them, poetry was fallen music, and prose is fallen poetry. It's a falling away from the music with the chords and the notes to it, to poetry, which still at least has the rhythm and the cadence, down to prose, which is just slapped together. No, not really. But it's a lesser form in their mind than the poetry. So I found that to be very interesting. So as we talk about music, keep these nine muses in mind. So I want to look at another poem by Catullus. This one, I think, would actually be fine for your logic students. You might have to gloss a few words, like a present subjunctive here. But it's his first poem to his book. It's his dedicatory poem. And this is one that you could probably do with some students who've had a little bit more grammar. This poem is actually written in hendecasyllabic meter. I love to teach poetry in my classes, and I enjoy teaching meter, and the students actually really enjoy hearing it. I often liken it actually to rap, because the beat comes through so clearly. I said it's not about rhyme, it's about rhythm, it's about keeping a pace. And I like teaching this one first. Typically the one you hear taught in schools is dactylic hexameter. This is hendecasyllabic, from the Greek hendeka, meaning 11. It has 11 syllables in a line, and it's got a very consistent pattern of we have spondy, dactyl, troche, and then either a troche or a spondy at the end. It's very consistent. And these are systems of long and short syllables. Doesn't necessarily mean it has a long mark on it. I won't go into that whole lesson, but there's a you can easily find online or in a lot of Excel textbooks how to scan poetry. But there's a nice rhythm here. So if I was to read this, I'm going to look at my sheets. I'm not trying to read off the screen. It would go something like this. Qui dono lepidum novum libellum. So you can kind of hear that rhythm in it, right? Arida modo pumic expolitum. You hear that rhythm and pattern in it. Well, that's a very interesting thing to get them to understand kind of the origins of poetry and rhythm and meter and scansion in other languages. But then you can bring it on back to their English poetry class. Tennyson loved Catullus, very much liked him. He has one poem called Avatque Vale, which is riffing off of Catullus's 101 about his grief of his brother, as well as 31, which is his longing and his tribute to Sirmio, his island home. He brings both images from both those poems in there. So if they've read those two Latin poems, please read that one by Tennyson. Here's another fun one. So Tennyson is playing with Catullus's meter, and the title of the poem is hendecasyllabic. And now you can talk about how it's not so much long and short syllables. In English, it's stressed and unstressed syllables. So here we have the exact same pattern. It'd be something like, oh, you chorus of indolent reviewers, irresponsible indolent reviewers. And it's so fun because he's reading this poem. He's talking about critics and how critics are going to criticize him for his hendecasyllabic. And it's a really fun poem to read, especially if they've gone through and read that meter. So here, we can do a study on poetry and meter, which you can then carry over into Shakespeare and his iambic pentameter that he does in some of his plays and his free verse that he plays around with. But we can tie that all back into Latin and where that comes from. And where does that rhythm come from? And how did Tennyson and Shakespeare evolve past that? So, as I said, poetry is connected to history. Now, there's no better way to get your students' attention than to say, tomorrow when you come to class, we'll be enjoying some bacon during Latin. And then give them this. So this is the less tasty Sir Francis Bacon, who wrote a history of the reign of Henry VII, King of England. This is actually taken out of my Latin Alive history reader, and I'm going to zero in on the bottom half of this page. This is a story about the marriage of Henry VII to Elizabeth, and it's the marriage that brought an end to the War of Roses, because they were the uniting the two houses. Now, this was a perfect passage to read this year, because all of my girls are caught up in the royal wedding. So here we're reading about a royal wedding. Okay, so if I zero in on this passage up here, I'm looking at the second half of it, and so the first thing I'm going to want to do is talk to them a little bit about the history of the piece, right? Oops, wrong button. That's the button I want, okay? So we could go back and recall the succession of the kings and talk about the Tudors, okay, and the War of the Roses. We could talk about the past calamities, because he's going to reference those. Not go into detail, but he's going to reference past calamities. So as we read about his referencing those, what calamities was he talking about? So we can have some really good context content discussions about Bacon and about the history of this family feud. Then we can talk about rhetorical devices. So the first one I want to point out is a simile. I don't know, some of you at the front might be able to see this better than the others, but up here in line 7, we see this word veluti. Right? And we see it down towards the bottom here in line 11, too, which when you teach simile in an English class, you're always looking for what keywords? Like and as. So veluti is one of those words, and sicut also are good ones to look for in Latin, where you can trigger, it's a trigger word, right? Yes, it's a simile, right? So they were receiving, I'm going to read off here, they were receiving him truly just as a prince sent down from the heavens. And a heavenly prince sent down. So we're also using a rhetorical device called an allusion, right? In Bacon's time, and this allusion would not work in the time of Cicero, perhaps, but in Bacon's time, what is he referencing by saying, they received him as a prince coming down from the heavens? I heard somebody say it. Jesus, so like a savior. Now, I'm sure he's not calling Henry God, but the idea of a savior who's going to deliver us from calamity and trouble, right? So we can talk about that rhetorical device being used. Right here, this is a very interesting piece because he talks about which it is allowed in the times, Enrique Corti, Enrique Quinti, so that we have some nice number words too. We can talk about counting, right? I've got to go back over here. My apologies. Et aliquibus annis Enrique Sexti ex una parte et Eduardi Quarti, et cetera, et cetera. So what's interesting here is they start to use the ampersands for in place of the conjunction et. So that's an interesting thing to point out, and I see that in a lot of the medieval texts. But we go from this first part in using an asyndeton, he's not using conjunctions, to suddenly putting in conjunctions like a polysyndeton. It's like he does half and half. So I'm going to talk to him about why does he do that? A syndeton typically tends to speed up the feel of a reading, and polysyndeton tends to slow it down. Like when your mother says, I asked you to clean your room and do the dishes and do your homework and walk the dog, and you didn't do any of it. She's intentionally slowing down and piling up. Well, he's talking about in these times, but then also in a part in the time of this guy and in the time of this guy. So it could be that he's trying to somehow put in a quick succession and then slow the rhythm down. But that's an interesting discussion to have in terms of his style and how he's presenting that. All right, and in this last part, I love this last line that we concluded with, where it says, et sicut, so there you have another right simile, right? Et sicut ex victoria eius flexa sunt hominum genua, and just as... out of or because of his victory, the knees of men were bent, right? Ita ex nuptis Elizabethae destinatis etiam et corda. Thus, out of the marriage, the destined marriage to Elizabeth, also the hearts. he left something out. If I was diagramming a sentence in grammar school, they would be having a fit. What did he leave out? He didn't repeat the verb. I can't tell you how often my students get very frustrated because they'll read this first part just fine, and they'll go in, they're like, where's the verb? I can't find the verb. I'm panicked. Okay, well, sometimes a verb is intentionally omitted because perhaps that's too many words. It's a stylistic device, right? What is he implying about the hearts? Also the hearts. What were the hearts doing? They were bent. They were kneeling, right? Why? Because he was marrying Elizabeth, the opposing family. And by marrying her, they were bringing together the two houses, and they were ending the years of discord. So he won not only the loyalty, the obedience of the people out of his victory, but he won the hearts of the people out of this marriage. And all the girls go, oh. And the guys go, can we talk about war now? So there were some of my rhetorical devices. So syntax, I just talked about the omission of the verb, and I'm going to go ahead and move on from there for the sake of time. Okay, so this brings me to art. I love bringing art into Latin. I am not an artist, but my mother, my sister, my mother's first cousin, and my daughter are artists. So I'm surrounded by it, and I love it. In fact, when my sister was studying at the Art Institute of Chicago, she would often call me, and we would send each other paintings, and we'd have discussions, and she would talk all about the use of color and texture and lighting and arrangement, and I would talk about all the different symbols within the painting and be able to tell her the story behind them. So it was really a fun time for us to have these discussions. So this painting is an oil on canvas by Jacob Jordaens, about 1645. He was a Flemish painter. Does anybody want to guess what story is being depicted? Okay, not quite. Let's think Ovid, Metamorphoses. I should have given you more of a hint. This is the story of Balcus and Philemon and Jupiter and Mercury. So Jupiter and Mercury are roaming the earth looking for someone who was still pious and dutiful to the gods. And they come to the house of this little old couple, and the couple welcome them in, not knowing them, and begin to proceed to give them all the most gracious hospitality that there is and attend their needs. But this is a very poor couple. They're not well off. But they give them everything that they have. And as the husband starts pouring the wine, he starts to notice the wine just doesn't run out. It's kind of like the oil in the story with the prophet Elisha. It just doesn't run out. It keeps coming. They're like, this is strange. And they start to get the clue that perhaps these are gods. Now, I don't know if them being naked with just a robe around them had anything to do with that. I'm not sure I would invite two naked men into my house, but that's beside the point. So they bring them in, and they begin to realize they're gods, so they decide, oh, we've got to give them something even better. You know, the wife has actually brought in, you can see with her apron over here, she's brought in vegetables from her garden to serve them. So they decide we're going to give them our goose. Well, geese back in that age were actually like their watchdogs. It could be a pet and a watchdog. I mean, if you've been around an angry goose, you know it's a good watch pet. So they chase down the goose to try to cook the goose, and the goose flees under the table between the god's legs because I guess the goose knows you can save me. So that's what the artist is incorporating into this. If I was in a grammar school classroom or a logical classroom, maybe they aren't ready to read Ovid's Metamorphoses yet and see this painting. Another way I might do this is start to ask the students, and I think this is a really fun painting to do this. It's also age appropriate because everything is covered. Well, nearly. Is to say, what things do you see in this painting? So what type of things do you see in this painting? Generosity, okay. Sacrifice. Okay. Think in the mind of a grammar school student. A goose. Good job. A cat. Yes. You know, it's funny how many of these Renaissance paintings have a little cat or a dog in a corner someplace. My students love that. There is no cat in Ovid, but there's a cat there. Good. What else do we see? Carrots. Pardon? Carrots. Okay, she sees carrots. Good. We might also say vegetables. What other food do we see? Fruit on the table. Can anybody make out what kind of fruit? There are grapes, green grapes or purple grapes. Okay, we have purple grapes. What else do we have? Chair. There's a chair knocked over. Okay. Look down here over in the corner, too. Do you notice the fire in the fireplace? Okay. And then we talked about the wine already. So in a grammar school classroom, we might talk through those things, and then I might read the story in English and say, I want you to hear, listen, and see if any of the things we talked about are in the story. Did the artist do a nice job of interpreting that story? Now, if I want to do this in Latin class, I could still do the same thing. I could ask them, okay, we've talked about these things in English. Can you find some Latin words for any of the things you've talked about? Anybody? Pardon? Cella. Okay, good. Chair. Mm-hmm. Mensa. Good. Table. The goose on sale. Mm-hmm. Vino. Vino. Yeah, what else? Weir. Good, we have a weir. Pardon? Senex. Good. Excellent. Being more specific. Yes. What about down here? Ignis, okay. Oh, yes, okay. Juvenis, okay. Good, so a lot of these words. Here's some of the words. I'm not going to read the, it's a longer passage, but here's some of the words that Ovid actually uses in telling the story. Casa, pauper, right, poor. Sinex, ignis, flamas. Tepidum cinerum, warm ash, right. Coniunx, suus coniunx, meaning his wife, okay. Horto, it talks about her contegerat horto, bringing in from the garden, right? So garden vegetables. Sordida terga, right? So we have sordida, dirty. We have mensam is a word he uses. And we actually have purpurea uvae, purple grapes. He mentions those. So that's another interesting one, too, is to ask them to come up with these Latin words and then either read the story aloud, or you might hand them the passage and read aloud at the same time and say, what words do we still see? Even if they can't read the whole passage, we could still see how this artist is being inspired by this story. And not just the story in general, but the story the way it was written. Here's one other one that I really enjoyed doing. Sure. This one, again, is Jacob Jordanes, Jordanes. And the title is Jupiter and Mercury in the House of Balkis and Philemon. Mm-hmm. By the way, the 12th century is often known as the Itas Ovidiana, the Ovidian Age, because more art, painting, sculpture, reliefs, etc., were produced based on Ovid's Metamorphoses than any other work. And often I tell my students, if you know Ovid and Virgil and the Bible, you can go into any Renaissance section of an art gallery and pretty much know what you're looking at in terms of content. That's actually a really cool, powerful tool. Okay, so this one. So again, with the theme of Ovid, what story are we looking at? This one's a little bit harder, I think, to identify because there's just a slight detail that gives it away. Oh, you got it. Yeah, this is Icarus. I know. They were sitting closer to the front. Okay. And I love this one because it's this small detail. And so for the students, it might take them a while. But that's nice, too, because they're really having to search the painting and look at the details and think, what about this reminds me of something that we've read? Okay. This one is called Landscape with the Fall of Icarus by Peter Bruegel the Elder. And Bruegel really enjoyed doing landscape pieces of daily life. And you can see this is definitely a landscape piece of daily life with this guy falling out of the sky in the corner. Okay? So like it's a landscape with the fall of Icarus in the corner. This was painted about 1550. It is also in oil. Jacob Jordanes was a Flemish painter. Bruegel the Elder is Dutch. Now, this one I do a little bit differently. Once again, I might ask the students, what do you see happening in the painting besides Icarus? Plowing, good, right up here. Shepherding, good. Sailing, good. Port city, fishing, yes, good job. Right down here is a gentleman, and it's really hard to see if you're sitting back, but he actually does have a fishing pole. And right next to him, right down here, is a little basket where I guess he's putting his fish, right? Hopefully he doesn't hook Icarus. So we might talk then about Latin words for these. Does anybody recall the Latin word for fish? Piscis, good. What about for a shepherd? Pastor, good. What about for a plowman or to plow? Aro arare is to plow, and arator is the plowman. Good. So here are Ovid's exact words. I'm going to read them to you. So he's already talked about Daedalus and Icarus flying through the sky, Daedalus' famous admonition to keep the middle path. And then he goes here. He says, Hos aliquis tremula dum captat harudine pisces, aut pastor baculo with a stick, stivave inixus arator vidit. These are all things he sees. He sees et obstipuit. They see and they're stunned. Their mouth drops open. Quique aetheria carpore possent credidit esse deus. Right? So they believe they see someone to seize the aether and they think he's a god. But in Ovid, he talks about how there happens to be this guy fishing and another guy plowing, another guy shepherding, and suddenly they see someone seizing the air and think they're a god. So Bruegel wasn't just thinking, oh, I think I'll do a landscape and put kickers in the corner. Bruegel was actually interpreting what Ovid wrote. And I think that's a fascinating thing to do for these students and say, look, guys, and by the way, Bruegel and Jordanes, they weren't likely reading a translation of Ovid. They were likely reading Ovid's actual words. And this, being artists, is what they saw in their mind's eye. And then I like to talk to them about the poet themselves, right? They didn't have videos, VCRs, Facebook, social media. These artists, literary artists, if you will, these poets, were trying to create images in your mind, evoke emotions from your heart, and they were doing it with words on a page, carefully chosen, carefully arranged, just like a painter might do with his choice of color and lighting and palette and placement of objects. And this is this painter interpreting one artist, basically interpreting another artist, just in a different medium. And for students who are very visual learners and like pictures and good stories, this is wonderful. And you don't have to be completely reading Ovid yet and be able to scan dactylic hexameter in order to do a similar exercise with your students and bring the fine arts into the classroom. I've had conversations with fine arts teachers that say, you know, we want to do everything we can to support the humanities and what they're learning, and we're trying to look at that time period and those techniques and themes, but it would be so nice if the humanities teachers would pull a little bit of art back into their classroom. Here's a way you can do that and really enrich their experience. And honestly, when I took my students to Italy, to the Borghese Gallery, to the Uffizi Gallery, they were able to walk through and identify all these different paintings. We'd walk out and I'd stop and say, hey, hold on just one second. Do you realize what you just did? How many people just rushed through and didn't really stop and look and know what they were looking at? Because of your classical education, because of all that we've read and discussed together, you knew what you were looking at. And that's a really, really inspiring thing. So here's music. This is from Vitruvius, who puts together 10 books on architecture. But in this chapter, this is actually a Latin passage. This is from the Rare Books Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. He's actually discussing the musical note. So I thought I would just take a moment to show music in terms of what we think of as music, and certainly as part of the lyric and the dance of the ancient world as well, but to show the mathematical elements of these nodes and these chords. So I'm transitioning here in this study from music from music and art into the math and sciences. But this too is a passage. I haven't explored this one, but there's just a wealth of material out there for you to bring in to capture the minds of your students. So let's go on to numbers. Speaking of numbers, I love doing numbers with students. This is taken out of the back of one of my books. I forget which one, but I'm telling you, any curriculum you use is going to have in the appendix section some sort of number list, right? I do some of this even with grammar school students. Roman numerals are typically a chapter in somebody's math curriculum somewhere, but they typically just do the numbers, right? I like to do also the cardinal and the ordinal numbers so they begin to see those, because those are going to become a part of their math vocabulary. And Roman numerals are fun because we see them everywhere. So one of the things I like to do, because I'm in Texas, I'm a Texan, I'm a sixth generation Texan. My roots are deep in the limestone here, but I married a New Englander. So Super Bowl time comes around, and we're doing a unit on Roman numerals, so I walk in wearing this, which, you know, the Cowboys were booing and hissing me. But I said, look, this is actual Latin reinforcement time. We're now integrating Latin studies with the NFL and the Super Bowl. And we go back through the Roman numerals for the different years, and they have to read these, and then it also just demonstrates the Patriots' success rate. But they have to add two more. So that's kind of a fun one, just to kind of break up the class and bring them in. But I like to go through the cardinal numbers and the ordinal numbers, talk about the difference between a cardinal and an ordinal and what they mean. If I put $5 bills out in front of you, there's a big difference whether I say the quinque or the quintus in terms of how much you get and how much I lose. So I like to demonstrate that with them. And then you can take this into the vocabulary of the sciences in things like angulus, meaning an angle, or calculus. Calculus actually means pebble. So I teach our calculus teach that he's really just teaching them about moving rocks around. And things like this, because then they begin to make these connections, and these math terms in their math class aren't just some random word that they have to suddenly connect an image to, but they're like, oh, actually that makes sense. An angulus is a corner. So when I'm looking at quadrilaterals and triangles, I'm looking at the corners of the shape, right? Or, for example, with calculus, and you talk about the abacus and the counting systems. This is where this comes from, is taking those pebbles and those devices and using them to help formulate and calculate things. Okay. Now, taking it from there, I can go on to talking about larger science passages, such as Newton and his Principia. Now, how many of you were able to go to any of Ravi Jain's talks while he was here? Oh, good. I really enjoy Ravi. He's a great guy. And well, I'm looking for my other note. I went to him one day as I was working on writing this book, and I said, Ravi, I really want to include something from math and science. What suggestions do you have for me? And he said, oh, you've got to do the Principia by Newton. And this was written in the 1600s. In fact, I believe the birth date, the publication date, is like July 6th. We're coming up on the 331st anniversary of the publication of the Principia. Been around a while. But he says that is the quintessential, the foundational work on mathematics and even the sciences. And of course, in there, one of the most notable passages is the laws, the three laws of motion, which most students, even if they haven't studied physics yet, they have some sort of familiarity with. And so I like doing that one because it's math, science, physics, but it's accessible and they have a context, a frame of reference with it. I also enjoy this one because, as you can see, I have a Renoir here from 1885 titled A Girl with a Hoop, and I have that one chosen for a reason. So in this first law that Newton puts together, and actually let me back up a little bit. When you teach these laws, it's very interesting. I would do them with advanced students. I would not do the laws themselves with the younger ones because the construction is just a teeny bit odd. Each law, and it's because it's scientific Latin. It's not poetry Latin. It's not historical prose. It's a scientific law. And you have to really understand something like lex dicit with each one, because they're all framed as if they were indirect discourse with an infinitive, right? So lex dicit, the law says, right, every body perseveres in its own state of resting or of moving uniformly in a direction. So we have an infinitive here. And that's going to trip them up if you don't prep them for that, right? Unless insofar as it is forced by an impressed strength to change that state. Each time Newton expresses a law, he expresses it distinctly like this. And what follows that I do not have on this slide is what he calls a scholia, which is an expounding upon that law, often with an example. And the example he gives for the first law is a trochus. A trochus is a trundling hoop. So think like a hula hoop, but flat. And this, the children of his day, and actually the trochus goes all the way back to the time of the Greeks and the Romans. We have mosaics with boys playing with their trundling hoops. You have a flat hoop, and if you can see, she has a stick in one hand. And the idea was to spin the hoop and go run alongside it and see how long you could keep it rolling. So he talks about that hoop as an example, and how the hoop is pulling itself in a perpetual motion and will continue to do so until it's slowed down by air or hit something. So I actually have this painting in the book, and I like to pull it out with them so I can kind of integrate a little bit of art, a little bit of science, a little bit of Latin, a little bit of grammar and rhetoric, all right here. The second law I also enjoy teaching, and this one I'm going to show you the scolia for. So this is what it looks like, at least in my reprinting, is you have the law up here, it's fairly short, and then you have a scolia afterwards, right? So this one, hold on, let me change my page. This one, if you look right here at line 10, says, si vis aliqua motum quem vis generet, if any force would generate, produce, right, any motion, and now we have dupla, duplum, tripla, triplum, generabit, so we can get back into numbers. And what does dupla duplum look like? What does tripla triplum look like? We can also talk about, as we did in the Bacon passage, how stylistically some authors like to omit a verb. So the students will look at this, dupla duplum. What do you mean twice, twice, double, double? This isn't Macbeth. There's no toil and trouble. So you have to go down to the end and you have to reuse your verb. And I point that out, English authors do this too, but it doesn't trip you up. But here they're so programmed into looking for that verb, this is a nice way of taking them out of that. So, you know, let's kind of go all the way through it and find it. We also come down to line 13, and if you can see it, we have words like auditor, subdicator, obliquo. So we start to get into it is added, it is taken away, subductor. Okay, so think about subtract. What does subtract really mean, right? I've dragged something under and away. What is added? I have brought it to. And those are both Latin derivatives. So, an obliquo, oblique, thinking about your obliques. Either oblique angles or perhaps obliques working out in the gym. But you can talk about obliques. So you can, again, take your math that you've perhaps gone with, taught them in grammar school or logic school, reviewed with them, and bring it here. And you can talk about these scientific principles in class. And it's a really engaging way to get the students to look at their Latin and talk about what is he saying, what examples is he giving, how does this reinforce the law? And before they know it, they're doing physics and Latin. And then you go, wait, look at what you just did. Now I like to take this step. Oh, I'm not advancing my slides like I should. So here are some of the mathematical terms I talked about. The physics lesson, and then again the syntax, the omission of the verb. Now, I like to take this one step further, and I mentioned this just briefly in the practicum 2 days ago, but that oftentimes when I finish a reading like this, and this would be for my advanced students, I really enjoy doing compositions. So if we've taken these three laws of motion, and I don't have time to get to the third, I might say, okay, we've talked about these examples that Newton has proposed, a trochus, right? And here, I forget what he's talking about. He's talking about just motion in general. In Law 3, he talks about it's every action has an, actually, he doesn't say every action. He says an action always has an equal and opposite reaction. And he talks about a finger pressing on a stone and how if the finger's pressing on the stone is actually pressing back on the finger. Right? And then he expands that to a horse pulling a stone with a rock, or pulling a rock with a rope, excuse me, and how that rope is actually pulling both on the horse and on the rock, not just on one. So we kind of walk through those examples and say, okay, now I want you to think of another example that uses Newton's laws of motion. And here's the one that we typically go to. Okay, baseball, good old American baseball. And since we're in Dallas, when in Texas, we root for the Texas Rangers, okay? So now I might ask, okay, let's talk about baseball. Let's talk about Newton's three laws of motion applied to baseball. And we talk through it a little bit. And then I say, okay, now what I want you to do is I want you to write your own scholia in Latin. And I want you to use some of Newton's vocabulary. I want you to imitate his style, the way he phrased things, the way he stated things. And I want you to pick one law of motion, restate the law, and talk about how, write your own scholia, if you will, on how that a law applies to something in the act of a baseball being thrown, hit by the bat, and the reaction that occurs. And they can pick whichever law they want to do. Okay, so now I've included grammar and rhetorical devices, because I will often tell them I want at least one rhetorical device in there. You can pick what it is, right? I've taken rhetoric, I've taken grammar, I've taken style, I've taken math and science, right? And I've brought them all together in this lovely little vessel of Latin. And I say, boom, there it is. Latin is the true liberal art. I even brought in athletic department. Okay. Another way to do this, for those of you who want to do AP Latin and looking at pre-AP, one of the essays they will have to write involves literary analysis of a passage where you have to cite Latin. You write an essay in English, but you have to cite Latin. So an alternative assignment I do might be to write about how Newton's three laws apply, all three laws apply to baseball, but they have to appropriately cite Newton's Latin in support of their answer. And that's a really great exercise. It's not only for people who are going to go into AP Latin and have to write those kind of essays, but it's also a great pre-rhetoric exercise, because I guarantee you their thesis teachers are going to talk to them over and over and over again about how to properly cite sources. And so you can teach them how to properly cite a Latin source in this passage. And then tell them you'll give them bonus points if on their thesis they cite Latin passages. So, okay. So that's it in a nutshell. Any questions? Marcus. Oh, that's good. Excellent. So how do I bring this into assessment? There are a number of ways to do this. I will sometimes, if final exams, I'll always give them a list of things we've read or done and say, these are possibilities, right? So I could put a portion of this passage on an exam, and I could ask them to translate as literally as possible. I could do short answer questions in Latin or in English. I'd like to do essays on my Latin final exams. I don't have them compose in Latin, but a literary analysis type essay on a final exam. For me, the composition assignment would be my final assessment on this, because I don't feel like every assessment has to be a test. Tests are good, but tests typically are limited in how they can assess. And different students respond to different assessments in different ways. So to me, a composition is another great way of showing I have read, I have understood, I have taken in, and now I can re-articulate on my own, right? So that's another way to assess that. But I do reading quizzes occasionally. I sometimes do reading comp multiple choice. I like to vary my style of assessments, in part because different students respond differently to different styles, and in part because I know these are all different types of assessments they're going to see in the future. For example, SATs and ACTs will use multiple choice and have essay questions, as will the AP exam. So I try to vary that. Other questions? Okay. Well, before we close, I will tell you that my lesson plan on Newton in this reading will appear next week on my blog site, as are many of my previous lesson plans already posted. So if you're looking for resources and ideas, you're welcome to go there. The website is latinaliveonline.com. So Latin Alive, and then online, N-O-L-I-N-E, it's all one word, .com. And you're welcome to go there and search and dig and see what you can find. Thank you so much for your time, and I'll be at the Classical Academic Press booth if you have any questions. Thank you.